Welcome back, everybody. Thank you for joining us here in the second hour with our members. We are talking with Jason Erb from FauxCapitalist.com about the Ottawa shooting and also, of course, how freedom of speech and freedom of the press is very much a threatened pearl in Canada, as it is in Sweden. It's being changed and transformed in a lot of Western countries right now. And, you know, I've been seeing as well, Jason, that you've been increasingly interested in the, you know, in Canadian interest as a European. You have some good people, of course, working on this in Canada, like Professor Ricardo Duchesne at the University of New Brunswick. We've had him on a couple of times. And just the whole issue of being a European Canadian, what that means, and if you in Canada are being the same level under attack for standing up for your own interests and rights as we are in the rest of the Western world right now. I mean, considering what the country is being turned into, but the fact who has been built by. How do you view this question of Canadians of European descent and standing up for your own interests? Is this something that's been problematic increasingly in Canada with multiculturalism and everything else?
Well, I'd say that Canada is at a real crossroads right now, because with the statistics the way they are now, if things continue as they are, that within 35 to 40 years that the white Europeans will be a minority in Canada. And you look to that from 1867, Canada's founding. Before that, it was the two different areas of the English and French that were then joined together. So there were a few hundred years of history before that, and before that as well. Besides the natives there, where unfortunately you had a lot of them die due to disease, which was not intentionally caused in majority of cases, but and you had the thing about with the government schooling and that, but in terms of the actions of the individuals, and you had Canada founded as with two founding nations, nations in terms of people of a common history, heritage, and that, and so there was the difference between the French and English. And that the French were a junior partner in that, and the evidence of that is that Canada was founded as an act of the British Parliament. But you had this whole notion within Parliament that English and French were the official languages in Parliament. Later it was rolled out as the official languages for the government services. But from 1867 then until 1971, it was unquestioned that Canada was a European-derived country. And to this very day, even with now visible minorities, which they define as non-white in color or non-European, that up until 1971, they had made up 96% of the population of Canada. So it's such a rapid change now that we're to about 20% then are they call visible minorities, which I better inform you, Henrik, they've now renamed it. Now, by our thought opinion leaders, that we're supposed to call them racialized individuals. But what's so unbelievable about that is that if you consider that race is just solely a social construct, then how are the white people also not racialized as well?
Oh yeah, right. Well, of course. No, but it fits when it does, and it fits when it doesn't, right? So it's just crazy, you know. So are you being whipped into pleading guilty for the genocide of the Indian tribes in Canada as well, even if you're, even if your family didn't have anything to do with that, or even if you're a later immigrant, what have you? Because we've seen this intensified rhetoric, of course, all over the Western world. But just on a flip side note of that, we don't hear anything about, for example, the plague of the Europeans, like the bubonic plague and the Black Death and everything else, when we actually had. A lot of that is today believed to be due to Asian immigration into Europe, and we caught diseases and were decimated too. But we don't hear too often about that, do we?
No, I hear about that argument being used so much in the comments section, which I had been looking to a lot lately, because unfortunately that there's been a lot of negative one-sided articles there by the top mass media, including unfortunately our national broadcaster. The CBC, which is very timely with this interview, didn't time it this way, but apparently they decided that this week was the week to have over a dozen or more articles completely one-sided perspective about how white people are so racist and discriminatory that I could read a few of the articles just in the past 48 hours, but it's like too depressing in terms of then the kind of narrative that they're putting out there. And of course, I know in the case of Canada's largest newspaper, the Toronto Star, which at least has the largest circulation, that I look to their editorial board as anyone can, and they're all white individuals themselves, white European. So what is it then? I mean, if the diversity is like so good for the rest of the country and we're all so racist here, like I have to ask certain questions, like why don't they go and diversify their editorial board? And also that we're so racist that we're going and taking in the most number of immigrants, of non-European immigrants from around the world in a European-derived country, out of any of the countries in the world, and we're taking in the most number of immigrants per capita of any country in the world. Wow. And we've been having this. This is the point I make, is that it's unprecedented in terms of Canada. The United States is a similar route, although it's not as extensive. And despite you having in the United States that there's a big Hispanic population, well, at least the ones who are going into some of those states, that those were former territories of California, but you're having far more immigration as a percentage of the population in Canada. And it's specific to certain areas of basically China, India, and the Philippines accounts for so many of the immigrants. So we're getting this complete imbalance where it's going to be a real challenge then to the European people of Canada, whereby at least in the United States, it's like more regionalized. And also there is that historical thing. Plus, at least, you know, Spanish is a European language. And the Mexicans also, there's like at least a mixing with some of the settlers that came over. But with so many Chinese people then coming into Canada as well as Indian. And we're noticing, for instance, there are several cities in Canada now that are majority minority, whereby... And it makes it, it really just strains the definitions of visible minority when you have Canada's largest city, Toronto. Well, actually, it's almost 50-50, but Toronto, because they went and amalgamated a bunch of different parts of it, but it's pretty much 50-50. But the white Europeans are almost a minority in Toronto. Actually, it'll probably come out that way with the next census, which is every 5 years. The last one was in 2011. So probably when they have the next one, then it'll officially be a minority. But you actually do have some other big cities where it is minorities, so-called, make up the majority in Richmond, BC, and also in parts of Vancouver, and also Brampton. Now, that was a significant case where next to Toronto, where you actually had in 2001, it was 62% white European, and now the white Europeans are a minority at around 32%. And that was a few years ago, where the South Asians have just completely dominated that area in terms of moving into that area. And then as well, there's another place called Markham, which is more Chinese people there than any other group. And and I was reading one of the comments yesterday about one of these selective, like I say, really anti-white European articles by our national broadcaster. And so it's saying, like, he walked through Markham, this one particular town, city, and he flew China. And, well, I've been through there myself, and I felt the same thing, and that was probably about 10 years ago. And so this is the actual effect that it's having. But a recent thing that came up was in Richmond, which is next to Vancouver, that there's a big kerfuffle because there's actually some signs there of businesses that are completely in Chinese. There's no English even on it at all. And so then there's talk about, will this particular city be the first English-speaking place, at least in North America, town or city, will it be first one to actually mandate English on the signs? Because in Canada, we have the experience where the Quebecers ended up, the majority who are French, that they ended up taking back their city and their province from the Anglo establishment that had been running things, which was in alliance with the Roman Catholic Church as well. There was this unholy alliance, in my view, and in the view of a lot of the Quebecers then, who had the quiet revolution against that. So you had the Anglos, where basically there was the one leader of the Quebecois who said that it was like they wanted to be masters of their own house, and they were basically in the basement while there were a bunch of foreigners, the Anglos, that were going and running things for them, having a big party in the main area while they were stuck in the basement, even though they were the majority. And so they took back their province and their culture and their future. And in their particular case, and I don't advocate this overall because I come from a libertarian perspective, but in their way of that they did actually mandated that you have to have French signage, and that if unless your company is really small, then it has to have French spoken in the workplace, and this is, and also for the schooling, that unless your parents already gone to an English speaking school, then your kids cannot do that. You have to go, at least for the publicly funded. If you want private, go ahead, but for the publicly funded, it's only going to be available in French. And this is how they save themselves as an island surrounded by English-speaking people, and now a lot of Spanish-speaking people in, well, North America, but even within the U.S., not just Mexico, as part of that. But yeah, that is at least how they decided was the best way to save their culture. And what I have noticed is that there's really an assault against that whole mindset by the, you want to call it the Eastern Anglo establishment, and I could add other adjectives, and there's different groupings within that. But within the whole mass media, there is just such a hate on for what the Quebecois have done in going and asserting themselves. And there was the thing that where they actually, well, unfortunately, it was an unpopular government, talked about a values charter where they were saying, like, we would ban certain conspicuous symbols of religiosity. So it would ban the skull cap or the hijab. And a large cross in the actual government institutions of people who were employed for the government. And eventually they got defeated, so that wasn't passed. But there was this big outcry. And what was so unfortunate about it was that the people weren't understanding their perspective of that they would otherwise be under threat, that they have this view that they have a distinct society within Canada, but the rest of the media that was so hell-bent against it, because the last thing I see that they want is the rest of the Canadians to go and assert their interests, for the European Canadians to assert their interests in a similar way, especially as I'm talking about in a place like Richmond, BC, which is like majority Chinese.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Is it the same in Canada as it is in Sweden now, for example, where all the groups that are coming in are not expected to kind of adjust to the host culture in any capacity? They're very much allowed to do whatever they want and speak whatever language they want, group with whoever they want, etc. Because from my perspective, when I've been able to tell on the American continent, the Asians are really bad on so-called diversity, and they keep very much to their own culture. I mean, it's kind of that's colonialism, really, right? Isn't it? They're traveling around to other parts of the world, Europe and the West, America, and setting up their own colonies. I don't understand how that can be acceptable when it's not acceptable for Europeans to do that. Not even in their own countries, mind you.
Yeah, that's the word that I've heard used. And I could certainly see that in the case of near Vancouver there, and with that one city, Richmond, right next to it. That is the word that has been used about is Chinese colonization. And you will have some academics say that, oh, it's not the Europeans. And actually, specifically the British and the French then who founded Canada originally. But then you had different European institutions like Parliament coming originally from Iceland. And so there are, and the Roman law before that. So it really is a European thing, but you have some academics over in Vancouver that happen to be Chinese, but not exclusively. Of course, you can get others arguing the same thing. It's what I would say, agree with Ricardo Duchesne about the cultural Marxists. But in this particular advocacy of Chinese ethnic interests, that talking about that, well, the Chinese were there right from the beginning in Canada of going and building the railway. And unfortunately, you had like a bunch of Chinese that died doing that because they were at least considered expendable, more expendable than by the people who were going and building the railways. And again, that's gone and used to. That is one of the ways, at least subtle, then subconscious, at least if they wouldn't openly advocate, that is one of the ways of saying this is why this is allowed. Like, they wouldn't agree that it's colonization, but at least that's something at play there. It's like, well, you guys screwed us over in the past by not valuing our lives the same as the your fellow Europeans. And even there was people were really concerned about the Irish at first. So again, that whole thing goes out the window about that, you know, the European, the white people were just so uniquely racist against Chinese or whatever. Yeah, actually, yeah. That whole thing breaks apart because really what the whole head tax was about is Ricardo Duchesne. It illustrates in an academic way is that was about protecting the wages and about protecting the jobs than for the European people who had been living there for a while and who made up the vast majority of the population there. And because there was that whole issue, if they just flew the borders wide open, that we would have had probably a Chinese majority province maybe a long time ago. Before multiculturalism became the official policy of the government of Canada. And so you do see that in terms of that if there is a group of Chinese people then where they can get by their whole day without talking any English. And now this is, of course, this doesn't apply to the youngest people, the ones who are born in Canada, or to the ones who have like really well-paying jobs. They absolutely have to know English and to integrate more. But I, with my own experiences of when I went to the University of Waterloo, I did see an issue whereby the Chinese people especially stood out from the others in terms of certainly a strong sense of their identity and history in that, and really pursuing their ethnic interests, which is completely forbidden then to the white European people. Yeah. In Canada.
Yeah. What's quirky about this is that they're called minorities, but obviously they're global majorities. If we look at, you know, Canada around 2013, estimated around 35 million people. And what estimation is like 7-8 million people are immigrants, not European Canadians. So maybe we're down to about 28 million. But many of the other ethnicities that are coming into Canada, they outweigh that. By long shot, you know, Philippines are about 100 million, China is over a billion, you know, and there's, so it's very applicable when it works for them. And the other line that I'm trying to argue here as well is that most of these other minorities that are coming in, they still have their own countries in place, intact. I mean, Canada is composed of Europeans, and Europe is not being turned multicultural anymore. It's not exclusive, well, they're trying to do it this way, but it's like it's not exclusively Europeans living there anymore. So, I mean, is this not a legitimate point of concern for Europeans to have? How is it that they've managed so successfully to keep our interests of the books while every other race and ethnicity can have their own, you know, student unions, they can have their own, you know, lobby groups to push their interests, etc. It's like Europeans don't exist anymore. We're just kind of there to uphold the structure that is going to be catering to everyone else, right?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this whole issue for the last year a lot, and especially over the past few months more and more, as I see, like I was talking about with the national broadcaster this week, just coming out with article after article, making the white European Canadians feel so guilty that supposedly collective punishment that had been banned. The Nuremberg trials that we're no longer allowed to have collective punishment and guilt, but that's exactly what's being done with our own tax dollars too.
Yeah.
Of the majority of the country is still white European, 75%, and that we're actually going and financing then our own collective guilt and displacement overall.
Yeah.
But I really thought a lot about this recently is, I think one of the big things was that we were really conquered in terms of our minds with the education system. And so much of this came out of since the 1960s, at least this is when it was rolled out. Because I was looking to an interview that was done with one of the lawyers then of Arthur Topham, who unfortunately passed away, but he was one of the great defenders then of freedom of speech, Douglas Christie. And I saw this interview with him from like the mid 80s. And the panelists there were just raving, stark raving cultural Marxists and they all happened to be white. One of them was a woman. And I checked up what they're up to these days. I didn't read too many of the one guy's articles, but I see they're still at it with their profession. But back in the 80s, so these guys would have already had to have gone through the school back in the 60s. This is really where I trace it to, is that you, in addition to the educational system, you had a complete abandonment then of any sort of really challenging faction, which was previously the dominant faction in terms of, you had Canada's prime minister, the longest serving in terms of the total number of years, William Lyon Mackenzie King, who who actually, and this was actually backed up by the Canadians as well, saying that the Canadians do not wish to change their immigration system such that it would go and change the ethnic composition of the country from being like a European country. I'm paraphrasing, but the gist of it is that the Canadians did not wish this kind of transformation. And I think he said that just after World War II.
Right.
And so we still have people who were around then. And of course, with Remembrance Day recently, then the veterans then who had served in that war. But you had this big shift then. In 1971 with the official policy of multiculturalism. But I trace it to the educational system of this thing that all races, first of all, they say that it's just a social construct. But you notice, for instance, that I remember even as a kid hearing about cystic fibrosis, about how that white people are more susceptible to that, and the sickle cell anemia, that black people are more susceptible to that. And actually, following the whole AIDS thing too, is that you have, it's been documented. Official records show that you have black people, for instance, can test a far more higher on the test. Now, this is where they say, oh, that's where it was targeted as a bioweapon. But actually, if you look for what it's measuring, it's just non-specific antibodies. And the point is, there's these big genetic differences. So as I started studying the AIDS thing, it just flew in the face for me even more. How can they say that race is just a social construct?
Yeah. Well, it's not based on real science anymore. As we know, they've thrown, genetics out the window for the sake of political correctness and you know, pushing this particular agenda that they have right now. But I mean, how do you feel about that? I mean, I don't know how long your family or ancestors have been in Canada, but how do you feel about that transformation taking place? And also at the same time then, Jason, knowing that the European countries that they came from is no longer exclusively European either. There's no country on the entire planet, as far as I know right now, that is exclusively European for Europeans. I don't mind that Asians have this or Africans have this or any other nationality. In fact, they should have that. But I understand that Canada and America have been formulated under different circumstances. Despite that, though, they do have they have been built, and the success of these nations have been built, primarily on Europeans and their efforts. But nonetheless, this aspect that Europe is changing and transforming, and on top of that, Canada and America and all these countries as well. How do you feel about that?
Well, I wanted to mention another factor too that I think has been influencing people's thinking ever since the 60s. But also, even myself, up until I went to university in 1997, the town that I grew up in was like 98% white European. And when I had lived close enough to Toronto, but even Toronto itself had become quote unquote so diverse over the past three decades and a bit more than that. Even there was a big change even with that within that time, but even since 1990, never mind about just since 1971, and so a big thing is that until I went to university, I didn't even have really any concept of my distinctness then out there in the big wide world regarding race or ethnicity as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sorry
to interrupt, but we don't as white people, do we? I mean, it's the same thing for me when I was growing up. It was not an issue at all. There's no ethnic interest, no ethnic consciousness there whatsoever. And in fact, we know through education and schooling that's been kind of bred out of us. And it, again, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's all bad when you live in a country where everyone is like you. You're, you know, a Sweden. It's all nice and dandy, right? But then you realize that on the bigger scale of things, all of a sudden, if you try to, you know, protect your own interests and say that, well, wait a minute, you know, Swedes are a minority in the world. Let's kind of, you know, watch out here a little bit because, you know, we want to have our own culture. We want to have our own country. And we want to make sure that this distinct people remains. But as soon as you begin talking like that, we know what happens and the labels come out, you know. So it's just unbelievable that it's gotten this far and it's been going for such a long time that people have just completely been, their awareness of this has been completely bred out of them. You know what I mean?
Yes, that's what I see with the education system. And then, of course, the media was the big thing in taking up on that as well and then reinforcing it and really hammering it home to this very day. But the thing is that another aspect is with, you mentioned about the United States and Europe, and the two things that really strike me is that being a Canadian growing up is that I was told by my parents about how like the Americans would never stand for certain things, like about tax increases, like, oh, we Canadians, and it was true, would just roll over when they would raise our taxes. And at one point we were paying far more in taxes than the Americans. Actually, it's come down now that if you live in certain areas of Canada, you actually pay less taxes than you do in the United States. It come as a shock, but it's been that way for several years now. Actually not that too surprising then for the people who have at least had some experience in Canada or looked into it. But the thing is, another aspect of that was I also looked to the United States of like, also the United States is on a road to no longer becoming a European type country, that it's not just really voluntarily, but because of all the shenanigans taking place with the educational system and the media and outright arm twisting and dirty handed tactics then by certain organizations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, mention their names, the SPLC and the ADL to name two big
sure,
ones, especially
of course
in the United States.
Yeah.
And we have our counterparts in Canada as well, the B'nai B'rith. But the thing is, it's not just that, but with Americans, I thought another thing is, my goodness, why would you go and abandon your European heritage so much in terms of that doesn't account for anything, the people who make up the country? Like, this is the one thing that really got me is that I wouldn't at all consider China to be authentically Chinese and that they would have any basis for claiming, oh, we're upholding our 5,000 year history, or whether it's 5,000 years or whether it's 2 or 3,000 years of real civilization. But the Chinese is one of the longest, fairly kind of continuing civilizations and cultures. But I wouldn't at all consider it authentic if a majority of the people were no longer ethnically Chinese, if they
exactly
were no longer the Han Chinese.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. Exactly. It's speaking about Toronto, by the way, is there white flight taking place in Canada as there is in many other countries around the world as well? I think the latest shocker was London, where I think 600,000 white native British people have left London and gone out to the countryside, I guess. And it's just a complete, population replacement that's taking place. And I mean, this is one of the, historically, if you look at it historically, this is one of the most radical transformations that are taking place. And it's being done, as you said, with subversive methods. It's being done through propaganda, really, and education. And it's done, in some cases, without asking people on a political, democratic level if this is what they want to have done. I don't understand how you cannot talk about this. It's such an in-your-face, major transformation that is happening that it should be on everyone's lips, and it should be something that we all should, you know, question what the motives are and why it's occurring. But white flight, is it the same in Canada?
Yeah, specifically with Toronto, what you had is you had white Europeans going and moving out to the suburbs originally. And I just take the case of my mom, the high school that she went to in Toronto, and I looked through her yearbooks. This is one of the things that got me, along with my uncle then, who went to a university in London, Ontario, that is, which significantly sized, and he went there for medical school. And I was like looking through there, and like nearly all the faces were white. And this is something that still stays in my mind to this very day, is what was so wrong about the society then that existed for over 100 years in Canada that we had to have mass replacement of the people of it with people from all around the world? What was so wrong about it? What, why did we have to race? We couldn't race fast enough. And actually the place that she grew up in used to be a transitionary place for working class people, but now it's one of the poorest areas in Canada, the Regent Park area. Actually, there's even worse places than that, but they have their cases of gang violence and that, and it's become institutionalized poverty there, and also welfare as well. And it's not diverse whatsoever, except for they admitted you actually had the host of Ontario's national provincial broadcaster admit that that diversity is a code for non-white. But it's not even diverse in terms of people from a different group as well in that area, but it's just completely transformed. And actually even by the 80s, I think by the late 80s, even that whole area had completely transformed. And now there aren't the no go areas, at least not during the daytime, though there are no go areas in Toronto at night where I would not be going, but you can't compare it to the United States, but they had their own history there. But again, this is a saddening thing, is that why that, yeah, you did have like to, I don't want to fall in, and this will never be my intent to fall into what the mass media scoundrels have been doing here with just providing a one-sided thing. But I almost can't speak enough about one particular side just to make up for all the censorship that has been taking place. But yeah, there was the issue of, but it was among fellow Europeans, where if you were Italian going in a certain area, you could get beaten up. So I don't want to pretend that there wasn't that, but that was like very specific then to certain ethnic groups. And that was kind of the way things were done back then. But now I notice the bad thing is that they have just completely whipped people so much in terms of their minds, that they can't even speak out about anything for fear of being called a name, let alone things coming to fisticuffs.
Well, it's just, I think a lot of people are, you know, kind of slowly realizing what's happening. And specifically when you take the agenda behind it into account, when you realize that it's a very subversive thing and it's a very sinister thing, it's actually by definition genocide. And I know people have contested that, but the very aspect is that if you, with intention, are seeking to replace the population somewhere, as happened in Tibet or what have you, there's other examples of this in history, then, you know, there were candlelight marches all over the Western world protecting these people, you know, and that's great. But the fact is, there is nothing being raised about this particular issue of European population replacement. And as you say, they say race is a social construct, doesn't exist, but then at the same time they're absolutely obsessed with it, because every time there are too many white people, if it's in a company or a workforce or whatever, the laws are put in place, and they do everything they can to, you know, quote, diversify, unquote, that particular area. Where do you think this is going to go, Jason, and how far could this proceed until people start realizing what really happens? I guess we can talk about, you know, kind of some what-if scenarios here, both of what the goal is with this, why this is being done, you think, and then also what happens if it's not stopped. Where is this going, do you think?
Yeah, I'm of two minds of this, because sometimes I see the case of that, like it takes a generation then to reprogram people's minds, and then with the whole government worship system that we have now, that the government just gets more and more involved with the publicly funded mandatory education system, where you can't go to a private school to send your kids to a private school or get any tuition refund for homeschooling them, unless you have like a bunch of money to afford that, it could take even longer than like 18 years even to reprogram people's minds. But what I see is, I don't know, I somehow have this patriotic hope as a Canadian, because I was really, it was actually the one time I was really proud to be a Canadian, really, in terms of what I realized that meant, when the Canadians, so many of them, spoke out against that whole bill where they wanted to register everyone's IP address and their address and everything like that. That was the first time I really felt proud as a Canadian. And when they talk about, oh, we want to increase the population, like, even if it's like all from Europe, like why would I want to see the population of this country increase if things are just going to be the same, or if we're going to be hijacked by foreign interests, mm-hmm. that I'm going to be a proud Canadian because of how we stand differently than others. And, you know, there was a famous quotation, at least by known to Canadians anyway, of one of our prime ministers who's on the $5 bill, Wilfrid Laurier. And there's a university named after him where I'm sitting here now in Waterloo. And he had said that the 19th century had belonged to the United States, but the 20th century will belong to Canada. And he was wrong, at least in terms of, well, pretty much overall, it turned out to be wrong because the United States was just so successful overall. Again, even up until more like the past 15 to 20 years, just a dominant European culture there in the United States. That again, you had the same sort of thing there, where it was at the height there of, I think around just after World War II, it was 90% white, even with the big black population, of course, historically, with those unscrupulous people bringing black people in as slaves. Mm-hmm. And then so that became part of their history, which is not the Canadian history in terms of having this big, what then became a big indigenous non-European population. And so the one thing is that I could see, there's the other frame of mind that I have whereby Canada could be like a shining light in terms of being more European Canadian, that it could somehow do what the United States, I think, seems to be incapable, disinterested, and so co-opted by foreign interests in doing, which is going and reasserting its European heritage. And the thing is, I think, you know, another thing is that you look to the Old Testament, for instance, and I find it interesting about mentioning about how the stranger can be welcomed and be part of the community. But what's put in there, it's not that the strangers would come in there and go and overwhelm the host community.
Well, of course, exactly.
and I'm not, I used to be raised Christian, but I'm not of that mindset since about over 10 years ago now. But the thing is that what I take out of that is the way I was raised, and even like in where I grew up was like 98% white, is that there were Chinese people and black people there, went to school. I did not see it as an issue, but when I came to the University of Waterloo in 1997, it just floored me in terms of, I actually said this when I interviewed Kevin MacDonald, that when I had read about his book, The Culture of Critique, in 1998, where he talked about an Asian technocratic elite and a Jewish business, media, professional, business elite, that I said I was living that, because in terms of the university that I went to, it was an Asian technocratic elite.
Yeah.
And even though you had like nearly, even at that time in 1997, you had like over 80% of the population was white European, that you had like around 40% of the student body that was in the program that I was in, or even 50% were Chinese.
Yeah.
Where they only made up 3% of the population of Canada, actually even less at the time. And even in Toronto only accounted for like 10 to 13% of the population.
So it's a huge misrepresentation there. And also, as we know, a lot of things aren't on, merit anymore. It's more important, you know, what color you are. And that will in some cases determine, at least in America, this is the case now, but I think it's increasingly so in Europe as well. But that will mostly determine, you know, in some cases, if you do get into the position, the job, or, you know, you get into the school or what have you. So it's all this aspect is unfair if there's too many whites in there, but as long as there's any other race overrepresented in there, that's fine too, right? It doesn't matter. I mean, I think the same in America too. We went by, I think it was Duke University, the campus there, and also, of course, on the West Coast, what's their name, Stanford and Berkeley, and was a tremendous amount of Asians in these schools. It was definitely majority Asians there, you know?
Yes. Yeah. Well, with the program that I was in, it'd be exactly the same over there. And then you do have like a, even overall, like a big Chinese contingent there. You see, so that was my first awakening then when I came to university. But I was up until last year, I was just of the mindset that, well, you know, we got to do something about, you can't have like a large group of people who aren't going and speaking the two official languages, especially like when I went through that one city, Markham, and it just looked completely Chinese. Like that was my thing right then. So ever since like 1997, like I saw the future of things now, of the way it was in certain areas. And then it'll become more apparent in Canada overall, except for the really rural areas. But I said, like, this is not the Canada that I want to be part of. Why would I want to be part of a Canada where there's just large groups of people that aren't part of the culture that I grew up in? Why would I want that? I didn't want that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I felt like a minority in my own country. And but why should I have to do that? And this is the thing, is that there was that little research thing that came out in the past year showing what we kind of already knew, was that when white European people are told that they'll become the minority in the United States, that they become more conservative. But then, predictably, I should have known it, if they were told that your social status will not go down, then they didn't have a problem with it. So, but the thing is, I got news for them, is your social status will go down. That, I mean, when I was in university in that, and where I was like working in the computer labs, Chinese would actually, I could count on both hands the number of times I ever heard the other official language of French, but I heard Chinese every day when I went to university. It was really jarring because you have like in these places where the parents, it'll be the only white kid then who, and actually even non-Chinese kid, and they have to pull them out of the school. Well, actually, particularly the daycare or whatever, because they just can't relate to them.
Yeah.
And this is amazing, is like you would actually have, like they even feel bad to have to do that. But like this is the way people have been conditioned, is that
yeah.
There's not, why would you, like, you shouldn't feel bad about that. That the Chinese people can, they have their culture. And yeah, they have English on the signs in the big cities in certain areas. That's an economic consideration, because English is the language of commerce. It's the international language de facto, just like French was diplomatically back in the 1700s. And so that's the real reason why they're doing it, because they want all the wealth that goes along with it. But we have in English-speaking Canada, we have that language there. And again, it goes back to what I noticed in is this complete demonization of the Quebecois. And I realized that I was wrong when I were part of, I wasn't some militant person about it, but I thought, you know, what's with these Quebec people? Why can't they just like let the people, if they want to have English on their signs, why do they have to force them to use it? But then I realized that I was wrong in terms of getting caught up in all that about, you know, there's different ways you can handle it, but they were trying to protect their culture.
Yeah.
And this is what that the elite then in Canada, they don't want that. Because, for instance, multiculturalism as official policy was brought in 1971. But it really didn't start showing its warts until the past 15 years or so. Because people are shocked, like, oh, like, what is with these people? They're not adopting the language. There's large, we're talking about like tens of thousands of people living in an area that are speaking Chinese or they're speaking Hindi or whatever,
yeah,
in certain areas. And like, that's actually what the multiculturalism encourages.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's what one of the biggest things I can impart upon Canadians and overall anyone who's looking, what multiculturalism, that's what it encourages. But until you had the twin sister then to go along with it of mass immigration. And to me, what I noticed was that this whole multiculturalism, it really belied an anti-white European sentiment, because Canada was such a multicultural country, but did not have an official policy of multiculturalism. That was the difference, was that you couldn't almost get more multicultural. We had all these different European peoples, big differences between the Eastern Europeans and the Western Europeans, and even differences of the Western Europeans, the North versus the South, the Nordics versus the Germanic versus the Greek. And yeah, And the different languages, of course, the European Union, like nearly 30 different languages that are spoken. And so when they said we want to have multiculturalism, that we want to have diversity, it's anti-white is what,
right.
What it is, anti-white European.
Yeah.
But I think a big thing is just even being able to talk about these issues. Like when I was first on your show, one of my big interests is in economics. I felt at the time, you know, depending on, what your audience was willing to hear. Even if I was to do a separate show, I wouldn't have talked the way that I'm talking now, because I think people really have to be ready to hear about that. And they need like a host also who's willing to be able to bring the guests then, who are willing to talk openly about these sort of issues. But it's like a learning process, as I was describing, since 1997, and then just last year, the way that I made the whole transition then of taking like a real pro-European stance on it is because like I realized that was essential. And to me, it was also significant about like you having Ricardo Deschain. I heard him on another show, and it led me to interview him myself. And he was just talking about the one thing. There's several aspects here, which I just want to briefly mention, but the one thing is that they could not allow that you would have this ethnic racial group of people that would just blow away the accomplishments of all the other groups of people.
Yeah.
You had the Chinese accomplish a lot, and they're ones that I put right up there, right behind the Europeans, but the Europeans just blew them away. When you look to the scientific method, to the architecture, to the laws, it's unparalleled what the Roman laws did. And then the British laws, which it's based upon, and the parliamentary system and the jury system. These are the things that really excite me personally. I know for a lot of people that doesn't, but that's really what I saw, is that it was absolutely essential to the identity of myself as a Canadian. And then I was suddenly realizing that I have this history going beyond just myself as an individual, that the Western society really formulated this whole notion, introduced it to the world, of individual rights. It was unprecedented in the rest of the world. And then I realized about how these whole rights are particular to a certain people that lived through this, their ancestors. And the thing is that when they go and teach about all these old white guys, as they say, it's not as relevant to people who had just recently come to this country. We're noticing this in terms of the lack of interest then of some of the students in these whole things. And what they had to do was they had to try to transform it to, it's like a world history. And there is a certain shared human history, absolutely, but it has a very specific European context. But what Ricardo Deschain really said, it just struck me on another show that he had done, about saying about how they just couldn't allow this, because here's the two things, two big things I see, is that there's the corporate agenda. That's one thing that's really killing us in terms of the promotion of mass immigration. But another thing is, there is an agenda to go and mix all the people of the world together.
Sure, yeah.
And the thing is that the big challenge, it was the European people who are the most dynamic and the most revolutionary in terms of affecting the rest of the world.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is something that absolutely has to be stoked out of existence to a large extent.
Exactly. They're seeking to control that. And it's too much of an unknown variable for them, I believe. I'm talking about the control mechanism now of our world, the true agenda to bring in globalization, internationalism, what have you. And in that capacity, they can't have people who are maybe too much out of the box or what have you, or have that capability of doing things which are unique in that capacity. But the time is dire, though. I mean, you're mentioning that it's very important to begin to talking about these things and recognizing the issue that we're faced with, and the reality of the situation is harsh. But it's just how it is. I mean, I think it's amazing that there hasn't sooner been a more open dialogue about this. Certainly, I know there are people who've been trying to bring awareness to this for many years, but at the same time, I think it's getting out there a little bit more, because now it's something that people can see in front of their eyes. They see how their own countries are being transformed and changing. And in some cases, they, as you said, depending on where they live in the country, they might end up feeling like they're strangers in their own country. And it's something that I think we can't neglect anymore. We have to address it. We have to talk about it. And it's extremely important. Is there anything else you want to mention about that before we move on? There's another thing I want to ask you a little bit more about in terms of the economics aspect. We have some interesting insiders speaking out from the World Bank and whatnot. We'll get to that in a little bit, but just want to let you know if there's anything else, or ask you if there's anything else you want to address before we leave that topic, Jason.
Well, I think the biggest cure for the malaise that we have now is the free expression of people's feelings. And you're noticing this in the comment sections of in the past couple of days and on these articles. The vast majority of them are calling out the editors of these articles and saying, like, you're fanning the flames of future racial hatred. You're creating mm-hmm. problems
yeah.
where they don't exist. And they're deliberately and very blatantly creating feelings of collective guilt and collective and eventually what they would want is collective punishment. Now there is that whole thing of that the government being responsible for past things, so they are taking care of with the residential schools with the NATOs and that, where they were deliberately it was to take them away from their culture. Well, actually, the thing I notice about that is now with the government policies in place progressively, you can't compare it directly. What I see is now they're going in. Apparently, the way to deal with that is to go and roll it out for the whole population. And even in a not direct way, but I have heard some people talk about with the more and more encroaching government control over our lives, like to some extent, we're being treated like the natives were, of that you can't build certain additions on your home unless you get a permit. Yeah. Never mind, it's not going to affect anyone else directly right next to you. You can't go and use the property for what you want to use it in a peaceful way. And so with that, the property use, plus also in terms of annihilating all culture, yeah, the majority of Canadians, they do not support these policies. They do not, because there was never a vote on this. And actually, the big change came in 1988, where unprecedented that we are bringing in sustained mass non-European immigration. And actually, it's even more unprecedented than that. You'd think that there would at least be an outcry among the cultural Marxists, perhaps. Well, maybe they don't care at all. But it's even unprecedented of any mass immigration in a sustained way, period, because the great key to the success of Canada along with the U.S. is that you had these waves of European immigrants, and then they brought it down so that they could actually go and blend into the majority culture, which was a British or French culture.
Yep.
And they're not doing that in any case. Even if they were bringing in just only Europeans, I would still have a problem with them not going and reducing it when it needs to be.
Yeah, exactly. Another point on this before we move on here, but I want to ask you about how things are in Alaska pertaining to this, but I've seen things in Canada regarding this, because I've seen things on Alaska shows, various shows, where actually anybody who is of European descent do not have certain rights, for example, to when it comes to, like, you know, shooting a caribou or hunting a seal or whatnot. It's like, this is actually reserved for different, you know, Inupiaq peoples or, you know, Eskimos or what have you. And they talk quite proudly about, you know, their native ways and whatnot. But what's funny about it is they go, you know, to these hunts with their motorboats and using rifles and hunting firearms and whatnot that were brought there by Europeans. But so it's a tremendous double standard. And when you actually get excluded to certain, this is one example, of course, there are hundreds of these, not even getting into the whole affirmative action, details and all that stuff. But I've noticed that there's discrimination against white people on multiple fronts here. Is this something you've seen in Canada as well, where a lot of the, natives, as they call them, have more access to certain things than what Europeans have, and that they're kind of excluded from certain things due to their skin color and who they are?
Well, there was actually a controversy during the recent Ontario provincial election where there was a member for the so-called Progressive Conservatives, and she got booted from the party and ended up joining the Ontario Libertarian Party, which I'm a supporter of, and personally, because. And in that case, there was this big accusations of racism that because of some statements that she had made about the natives having, like, special rights regarding to not being taxed and things like that. And to the credit then of the leader, like, he wrote an article then going and defending that, because the cultural Marxist and the political Mandarins then in charge of Canada and of acceptable public opinion, they will not go and tolerate even any open discussion on this. They will shut it down immediately with accusations of racism. You can't even talk about, I myself, and so is the leader and other people, fully aware of the whole history with the Native people. And actually where I grew up then, there was an island nearby where there were Natives all living there on a particular reserve. So I'm familiar with them, and there are people living in the town that I went to. Mm-hmm. And so those of us who have studied the history, we're well aware of the whole history there. But the whole thing is what she actually talked about was valid, but you can't even mention this. It's like, you're racist. Like, you don't understand the history of what happened to the Natives. This is why they have this special provision that they don't have to pay taxes when they're on the reserve. But she was just making the point about that the businesses in this particular town, which was nearby a Native reserve, were at an uncompetitive disadvantage because right. the Natives could have all these supplies tax-free.
Yep.
And the people nearby, and they were being undercut. And like, yeah, that's the thing. I mean, obviously, when you get into the debate, you can point out if the person would actually think that there's no other context to it at all. But what was being advocated for was, let's have fairness.
Well, like, exactly. We'll
go and implement the treaties, but let's have some fairness here. And frankly, let's have an open discussion without being called racist. I saw in the national broadcaster comments section today, someone going and mentioning the name of that woman in relation to a particular article where I'll just mention because it's relevant here is like this article is about racism gets in the way of romance, says new CBC poll.
Right. Oh, man. Yeah. Well, we know that now. That's what they do to shut down the debate. And it's never about rationality or valid, you know, arguments or whatnot. It's just about country trying to paint people in as bad light as possible, as quickly as they can, you know, character assassination and all that good stuff, right? So, well, I'm glad you're talking about it and speaking out about it and actually recognizing that this is something that's, you know, happening, because that's what we need to do to start addressing some of these problems because they are mounting. It's a huge issue that we have in front of us here. But let's just switch over a little bit. Last topic here for today, Jason. Want to get your take because you've written some good stuff on this as well. But insiders, whistleblowers speaking out here from the World Bank and throwing around some of the usual suspects and whatnot. Karen Hudes, what's your take on her? We did a show with her a couple of months ago now, and it's actually been one of the most viewed videos on YouTube that we did. Definitely over 150, 160,000 views. And I'm still trying to figure out and struggle, is it because people really liked it and they are, you know, kind of fascinated with everything she had to say? Or is it that they actually are quite confused in terms of, you know, I basically tried to get more out of her, what her goals were, what she's seeking as replacement economics and everything else, because she's a, you know, former World Bank name. So she's high profile in that regard. And I think people are interested in that. But I found it very difficult to get something tangible out of this woman, unfortunately, and it turned more into kind of a, I guess, metaphysical discussion to a certain extent. What's your analysis of this? Because you've been looking at, you know, alternative currencies and, you know, insiders speaking out and try to get a better idea of where to go next with the economic system. And then, of course, people like this come along the way and offer kind of very nebulous suggestions and whatnot. What's your take on her and what she advocates, Jason?
Yeah, I really got introduced to her when she actually came to my article and wrote so many comments and going and challenging me on some of my little editorial at the beginning and then actually summarizing down to minute by minute in terms of my characterization. It was pretty close exactly to, I try to endeavor to exactly what is being said there. And that actually was my second most popular article ever. Again, so I'm like wondering, you know, but I know it's because what she stands for, being a part of the World Bank beforehand, and then it is a big concern for people about economics. And then whenever there's someone who's coming out saying that they're a whistleblower, then that's going to get attention more than someone who may have been blogging and doing a lot of great research and writing great articles for 6 years or whatever. all the different great bloggers out there. But I first heard of her in the second half of 2013, and two red flags were immediately raised for me. And I made this clear in the article as well. And this is actually a reason why I did not interview her myself, that I definitely could, because she was very available going on pretty much any show that would have her on. And which is great if you're a real whistleblower, that's just great. And that is totally believable that you can get on all these alternative internet radio shows. I wouldn't believe for 1 minute if she would, or anyone else, a real whistleblower, would get on CNN or something. Then I would have immediately strong doubts about their credibility. But because of basically being controlled opposition in that case. But there were two red flags that were immediately introduced. And I really take a kind of a hardline approach in not interviewing these people based on my own understanding. But it was great to have her on your show for a reason I'll mention later, because this is what really got the discussion going more. But the two red flags were that she was calling for the currencies to be minted with gold. And the thing is, I had written an article back in 2010 about the World Bank president at the time, Robert Zoellick, was actually calling for some sort of linkage to gold. And he was running away from the term gold standard. But he was calling for some sort of linkage with the dollar specifically, and even the other, these big currencies, with gold. And the thing is that thanks to the work of George Whitehurst Berry, who had a show on another network from 2007 till 2012, when it was canceled under somewhat suspicious circumstances, was that he actually had read these books from the 1800s that was talking about how the international banksters were going and they go and run their little Ponzi scheme operation of going and pumping up the money supply. And then they would come in as the saviors with calling for a gold standard. Well, now we can limit the money that the governments can spend on things, and we can bring the system under control. Because, you know, we need to do that. And, of course, they have their heroes out there that they get to go and push this, whether they're willing or unwitting dupes. But pushing it in terms of, this is going to bring the government under control, and the bankers can't go and manipulate the money supply. We're like the way it was up until 1933, where it had to be 40% of all the dollars then had to have gold backing, that you could redeem it in gold. And then in 1971, when the international exchange thing was ended, but again, there wasn't that hard kind of backing like there had been domestically. But still, they were required to do it until Nixon said, no, we're not going to do that anymore. But George Whitehurst Berry, reading from these books from the 1800s, just describing exactly what had been done and what they were talking about, he was saying, yep, they're going to pull out this whole gold standard thing again, and they're going to pitch it as going and saving you guys, that this is a thing for the people to go and limit. So that right there, when she was calling for minting currencies with gold, that raised another red flag. But then the other thing that raised a red flag, which guaranteed I didn't want to interview her, was when she was talking that actually the Jesuits are the ones who are in control of the world financial system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the thing is that, and when I was on your show the last time, and we talked about the history of Europe, and we talked about usury, and I had mentioned about how the kings of Europe, see, there was this sneaky little alliance where working against the best interests of the wide majority of the people was these unscrupulous kings then who would have some Jewish money lenders then who would be given special like court protection, and they could go and lend the money, because in Judaism, it's not illegal to go and lend it money at interest to Gentiles. And of course, back then, actually, overall, people were more religious. Now that's less of a thing. It's really about pursuing one's ethnic interests, unless you're the evangelicals who are still going and following so much of the religious guidance, at least the way that they see it. But the aspect is that, you know, the Jesuits are a new... Are like a relatively new group. They don't have a kind of 2,000-year history within Western civilization. And the whole issue is that, to me, it seemed at least it seemed at least like I could see how what she's saying, that it could get a certain currency among people, because conveniently by that point you had the first ever openly Jesuit Pope.
Right. Yeah.
And so that is something where you could draw a lot of people into that. You could have them thinking that really, really this is the whole issue. But I personally don't see that it's like one monolithic group of like one big mind controlling things. But I do see that there are certain groups especially that have a history and that have for various different reasons for like ethnic solidarity. And also that's the thing of like being seen as the other. And therefore gives you that kind of identity, and that gives you more of a solidarity. And so that's the thing is that, I mean, you just look to, I didn't go and mention in the article because I didn't want to get pulled into the kind of thing that I saw her bringing it to. But I just said, I mean, is Ben Bernanke, is Janet Yellen, is Alan Greenspan,
are they Jesuits?
Yeah, are they Jesuits? That's what I asked.
Yeah.
Well, no, as it turns out, they're Jewish. And so this is the big issue for me. Like, I'm not around to point fingers, but and there's a lot of discussion, like Kevin McDonald gets into the reason, which I subscribe to about in terms of pursuing ethnic interests is the biggest explanation for it. But the thing is that I am not going to stand for what I just see as blatant disinformation, whether she's deliberately originating it or whether that she's just gone upon it, that I'm not going to go for that it's the Jesuits behind it. When also the last head of the EU bank, Jean-Claude Trichet, is Jewish, and that Robert Zoellick is Jewish, and that the World Bank head, who was also the neocon there, Paul Wolfowitz is also Jewish.
Yep.
Now there's the argument, well, they just happen to be Jewish. I don't buy that because there's a lot of Jewish people in very different prominent positions, as Kevin McDonald had talked about, that they was moving towards a Jewish business and professional elite because of the ethnic networking and that. But so I'm just not going to stand for people going and saying that this thing is Jesuit, when you can just look at openly the people in the top positions there, at least the front people. And so that was the big problem I had there. And actually, I think it was a guest on your show one time who talked about how there's this historical push to, it's why you actually know, E. Michael Jones actually, if it wasn't on your show, but on another one, where he actually talked about there has been this thing throughout history to go and criticize and demonize and like put heat so much on the Roman Catholic Church. So I have absolutely no connection and affinity with the Roman Catholic Church. But I once I started paying attention to it, I also noticed the same thing. And this is what I noticed that she was doing.
It's definitely a mainstream line of criticism. I mean, again, it doesn't mean, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. You know, you do have that, and I'm not saying there's innocent lambs or whatnot, but there's certainly a lot of different organizations, a lot of religious, schools of thoughts and groupings that you could look at and criticize and everything. But it's been a very, very kosher target, the Catholic Church, in the last 10, 15 years, with even an increasing frequency, I think. And I think that this is kind of, it's you know, one of those scenarios when it's kind of avoiding the elephant in the room here a little bit and recognizing what's right in front of your face and immediately jumping to the Jesuit conspiracy. I mean, as you said, they've been around since what, like the 1500s, mid 1500s or something like that. They don't have a 2,000-4,000 year history of being famous for handling European finances, if you know what I mean, right?
Right. Yeah. Like, to me, it lacks intellectual rigor. Like, I don't want to be judgmental of putting myself up there, but just if I want to look at least the front men that they put out there, and they're not Jesuits. So the thing to me is that, but what E. Michael Jones mentioned, like, I just saw that as serving that particular interest of going and taking heat off a particular group. And the thing is that, but then when she did the interview on your show, this is where I said, this is where I wrote an article. I went and pulled my punches. I didn't want to particularly write anything about her till that point, because what I had come to realize, it's really up to people to make up their own minds that that there are people you can put out all kinds of evidence and documentation for, and they'll just never see it that way, whereas other people just pick up on it like that. I've just been noticing this more and more with my independent research over the past 2 years in particular. And the thing is, like, a lot of people wouldn't have known what I did about those books from the 1800s, and also about, well, and then with the whole direction towards the Jesuit issue. But when she came on your show and actually talked about that there's another species on the planet, the big thing, this is what made me go and write the article, was that, is that you're going and mixing in things that are completely speculative and that have not been proven with actual provable things.
It's coneheads and Jesuits behind the banking system, right?
Yeah, that's what I thought it was even amazing enough when she said it was Jesuits, but then, oh no, there's actually another group behind the Jesuits. It's the coneheads that are another species. And oh, by the way, Moses was also one of these coneheads. That's what she said.
Right, right. Well, that's interesting. But the question is, again, is one of those cases you have to at least initially recognize the obviousness of where things is going and where the banking system, how it's been run in the last 50 to 100 years, and specifically with the World Bank formulating and all this kind of stuff, and where the power lies. And I mean, I'm not one who, it's always interesting hearing different ideas and theories. That's what this show is about, and listening to the possibility of it. But when you begin to weigh, you know, evidence against each other, I don't think it's necessary that we have to go into the Coneheads territory to figure out who's running the World Bank, you know?
Yeah, and I just want to mention, like, these are two really key updates then that I noticed when she changed her tact directly with me, because she had gone back and forth here and accusing me of not approving her comments, even though it was actually, hard to believe that WordPress can actually go and automatically put things in the spam box and you don't notice it for a day.
Right.
And you're accused of censoring or whatever. I understand it. People, if they are legitimate whistleblowers, and myself with the AIDS scam, trying to expose that, I have personally experienced censorship and that sort of thing. But the two updates was that she started talking about local currencies. I saw that she did talk about local currency just as a small little part. And then when I was on another show and she said, like, oh, what are you talking about? You're misrepresenting me about saying that I didn't talk about local currencies. Well, what I said is I never heard her talk about local currencies until recently, because I stopped following her regularly after a couple of months. But then what happened, the bottom line is, okay, she did talk about local currencies a bit, but the whole thrust of her argument is that there's this secret stash of gold that, by the way, is more than is currently reported to ever have existed. There's a separate stash of gold in this particular global debt facility, she calls it, and this person that she knows is supposedly the signatory to it, the guy who has the power over it, and somehow Ferdinand Marcos was involved in this. Somehow he got a hold of being involved in this huge stash of gold that's secretly being kept away. And she says, like, now we got to mint it and the world currencies. And then she took exception with me saying that that was a gold standard. But the thing is, to get into a little bit of the economic details, that actually you have the Austrians say that a free market gold standard is when you get rid of the taxes on gold and you go and get rid of the legal tender of forcing that debts have to be paid off with whatever they say it is. So that's the free market gold standard. And she, I read, was talking about going and getting rid of the legal tender laws. But she's saying, oh, initially we would have treasury notes. This was on some Reddit post, which actually she went away in a huff of claiming she had been censored there. There was some misunderstanding there. This is just in the past week, by the way. But she had talked about getting rid of the legal tender laws and having some treasury notes, and then having these gold coins minted by the different countries. Oh, but then we're going to have some local currencies. Well, the local currencies will be puny unless people really get involved with it and ensure that it's usury free. And another thing I asked her is that, hey, Karen, you're talking about these cone heads, but why don't you have anything to say about usury? And then after that, I noticed she starts talking about usury. She had never mentioned it before, and she didn't even challenge that when I mentioned. She didn't say, oh, you just haven't been looking. And then I noticed she's suddenly talking about usury. But it's all about the big thrust. It's like there's other big personalities out there who they will occasionally from time to time talk about certain issues. But if they're spending most of their time talking about other things, then you see really what the agenda is.
Yeah, I mean, I think Sterling Seagrave and Peggy Seagrave, that book is pretty interesting. The Gold Warriors that detail, you know, what they claim is some of the, you know, Second World War loot and whatnot. But it's still a very, it's been very difficult to kind of verify and pin down in terms of where and if that is, how it's going to be used. And I just felt a lot of it is built on an assumption that, you know, we have to like try to go after this gold, or in other words, it's been used in some capacity, and therefore, you know, now the whole economic system is being turned over. I think there's plenty enough that's been done to the economic system without that aspect to it that could be, you know, improved or whatnot, or you can, you know, you can steer it in the right direction without hinging it on something like this, which might or might not be a huge factor out there somewhere that could be a solvent in this kind of scenario. So I feel it's one of those things where, sure, it's interesting, you know, with the gold warriors and all that, with the loot, but it's not a necessary point to hinge things on. It's definitely enough could be done if we could take control of the banking system as it is and repair things and get the right people who actually have an interest at heart, not for themselves and their own group, their own tribe, but actually do it for a greater purpose of trying to get it on a good keel, if you will. So I don't know. I feel it's just a lot of mishmash kind of thrown around in there and a way, as usual, to kind of steer it in a different direction and get people to look at things when it's obvious that we have absolutely corruption within the banking system as it exists, you know, and we could begin there. Now, I don't know if Karen Hudis is Jewish herself. I heard that she was, and I saw some articles on that. I don't know if you've been able to verify that, but that would, of course, that would mean that she might have her own, for obvious reasons, an ethnic interest to try to, you know, steer away from that particular area. What do you make about that, Jason?
Well, yeah, she confirmed that she is Jewish, and I did especially didn't bring up that personal issue because I like to focus on the things that I can actually document and focus on solutions that are relevant to people. But she herself has admitted that, and then of course, just as we were talking earlier, that myself is a white European, I feel that I have ethnic interests and cultural interests, so that's perfectly acceptable for her than if she has some Jewish ethnic interests. That's just great.
Yeah.
But like kind of my final thoughts on the issue, it's like what you were hinting at is that a big thing is that what she's doing is she's externalizing the power of that you're relying on somehow, even if it was exactly as much gold as she's talking about, that somehow the savior of this whole economic woes that we're in, that it's by having this gold release that now we become so much dependent upon that instead of that the solution is within you. And I would like to announce that actually today is the start of the usury free week, where when I was on your show last year, actually I had given a talk in Toronto. We had talked about that I had presented this year. I'll just be blogging about things, but that a whole week where it's like dedicated to having no usury. That even though there's the Austrians will say, well, that's the free market. But the thing is that a free market can go and create interest-free, usury-free credit. And why would you want to go and buy some credit then if it's like paper or numbers in a computer where it's like usury attached to it in a truly free market?
Yeah.
So this is why they push gold, because, oh, you need to have some intrinsic value. But you don't need that. And there were different rulers down the ages where not only did they go and forgive the debts, because usury is inherently problematic in that regard. See, the Austrians come in there and say that, well, any amount of money can satisfy all the transactions. Yeah, but if you're the one who owes the money, that's not as good of a situation to be in as the one who's owed the money. Because the ones who are owed the money, probably you have enough money to insure yourself or to make contingency plans. That's the thing that they're not really bringing into the analysis. And so that's the big thing is I see it's like about taking solutions into their own hands, that we have people out there who have started these community usury free currencies who are actually walking the walk. And that's and the other thing is that I did notice she took a change in tack of suddenly I said, hey, what about the Coneheads? And she said, oh, no, now I'm leaving that up to the guy. I think his name is Edward Spencer, who's like a neurologist, who was the one who supposedly introduced her to the talk of the Coneheads. Now, but the thing is, what people need to realize is that that's already out there on the internet. Anyone who looks up about her will immediately associate reform of the monetary system with Coneheads.
Right, right. Yeah.
And to me, that again, it doesn't matter if, like, when she was mentioning about local currencies or increasing the amount of talk about it, that still the big thrust is about gold. And the other thing is there, that was actually cited by someone who was trying to say that she's putting out disinfo and actually made her run off in a huff from Reddit, was that this is what people are pointing to. But actually, they can get caught up in the same trap of focusing so much on what she's saying rather than taking steps to get their own house in order.
Well, exactly. It becomes this, cult of personalities and, focusing way too much on the surrounding stuff, to a certain extent, and what actually could be, done about the economic system at hand. And again, the huge problem we face, as you said, with usury and all this, playing with the world economic, system and all these kinds of things. So I think it's really important to just kind of bring attention to that and try to bring some balance to the picture and steer it in the right direction again, not to get too carried away with that. So, well, I'm glad we just got to talk a little bit about that, Jason, because I know you've written some stuff on that and I wanted to get your take on it and give our audience an opportunity to hear the opposite side to what she talked about on our show. So we do appreciate that. But yeah, Jason, as we begin to wrap things up here for this time, please, leave us with your website. Let us know if there's something you have upcoming or like to tell us about, something you have, in the wings or whatnot. You do a lot of good work over there. And of course you do your own podcast radio program, so people can go check that out as well. But yeah, please, the floor is yours, Jason.
Yeah, I invite all the interested listeners to go to fauxcapitalist.com, fauxcapitalist.com. As you said, check it out on the Red Ice Radio page there. And actually, the biggest thing that I would hope for now is for anyone who's interested in dropping me an email then at my address, then that's on my About page on my site. Just send me an email and about any of these issues that I've talked about today. The biggest thing I look forward to hearing from people, because with the new network that I went on to, I hardly hear from people. And to me, that was one of the best things, was the engagement during the show with some live calls and the chat room, and also some emails that I would get, especially the Canadians out there, to get in touch with me. I'd really appreciate that.
All right. Well, very good. Fauxcapitalist.com. Check out the website, and then of course go to the about us or about me page to get the contact details for Jason as well. Well, thank you, Jason. It's been good having you back. Thank you for your time today. Really appreciate it. Keep up the good work, and we'll do it again in the future.
All right. And I just want to thank you and Lana, Henrik, for what you have done here and going and opening up the dialogue, which to what I've seen, there's been no other platform that has had the reach of yours to talk about these issues. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Jason. Really appreciate that. We have to do it. We got to talk about it. Someone has to, right?
No, that's right, because what I noticed even in the Arthur Topham case, it's like a bit ridiculous, is you hardly even notice any alternative shows going and talking about it. In addition to that, there was only real one mass media thing even mentioning about his charges against them. So many things are just completely not even covered in even the alternative media.
Exactly. Absolutely. I mean, some of the issues that we do try to bring focus to are blatantly suppressed and censored. Just look at how iTunes treated us. There's such a tremendous taboo surrounding them for some reason. And I think we have to start addressing those. There's no need to go for long-winded, complicated conspiracies, although we do enjoy that sometimes too. But in this case, the conspiracy and the cover-up is right in front of your face. I mean, this is especially true concerning the fact that we as Europeans can't look after our own interests, for example, and you're not allowed to re-examine history. I mean, I'm surprised that more people won't address these issues, because it's really an area where we need focus right now, and attention needs to be brought to it if we are to persevere. So thank you so much, Jason, for what you're doing as well.
Thank you very much.
Before we finish for today, I just have a final note on the World Bank whistleblower story here, and I want to be upfront about this. I mean, don't get me wrong, I enjoy discussing hidden aspects of our past, things we aren't told about, conspiracies, and the things that are and have been hidden from us. I mean, we've been doing shows on these kinds of topics for years now, but it's also becoming more clear as to how some of these things are used to obfuscate the obviousness of certain issues, of course, by not recognizing the predatory element within the Western banking system and how usury is being used against its own people, for example. There's a big piece of the puzzle missing. I don't think we need the explanation of an alien race, although they might be alien to us, to explain what is happening currently. Sometimes a pipe is just a pipe, and we have to call a spade a spade. We do tend to miss the forest for all the trees, if you see where I'm coming from. We like to recognize the metaphysical aspects, the esoteric and the occult influences, but this shouldn't overrun our judgment when we are also in a world that is physical. We are influenced by the exoteric, and not only the occult, the hidden, but the obvious and the known as well. I think this is true for subversive propaganda as well, as we've been noticing in movies and television shows, for example. It's something that is hidden in plain sight right in front of your nose. And we shouldn't forget that. I think a balance between the two, the exoteric and the esoteric, that makes for a good overview. That's what I think anyway. Okay, well, thank you for listening today. We hope you do have some new things to consider then and put into context with consideration to previous shows that we've done and the ever-raging debates that goes on false flag terrorism to the discussions of what economic system is sound and what you actually can build on for something that is beneficial to the people as well. We'll be back in a few days. A Radio 314 with Lana Loktev is up next, an interview with Ali Aliabadi. On Red Ice Radio next, we have Neil Kramer on tribal, ethnic, and racial consciousness, the differences between us, and diversity as the Empire plans to make us all into one glob. After this, we have Lawrence Eastman, Carlos Morales, Jeff Gates, and many more. For now, we say thank you so much for being a member. My thanks to the Red Ice team as well for all their hard work, and we'll be back here soon. In the meantime, take care, stay healthy, and stay sharp. Have a good rest of your day or evening.